Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello everyone and welcome back to These Times. I'm Tom McTague.
And I'm Helen Thompson.
We're recording this week's episode early because of the bank holiday, and in the wake of another apocalyptic intervention by the French President Emmanuel Macron in The Economist, warning of the great new challenges to the US-led international order that are emerging today. And it's certainly true that great challenges are underway. In the Middle East, American hegemony is being openly challenged by Iran. In Asia, China is threatening American supremacy in technology. And in Europe, Russia has launched the most concerted attack on Western power since the Korean War of 1950. And yet, arguably, the greatest weapon in the American arsenal remains utterly dominant, and that's the US dollar. Today, the dollar dominates the world economy in trade, finance, banking, debt, and as a safe haven asset in an emergency. The dollar's primacy is also the basis for its sanctions against Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and of course, Russia. And it remains its one great advantage in the battle for global supremacy with China.
So the question we're going to ask in this week's episode is, why in a more multipolar economic and political world is the dollar still king? And what power does that give the United States?
In the past 7 years, there's been an average of one international monetary crisis every year. Now, who gains from these crises? Not the working man, not the investor, not the real producers of wealth. The gainers are the international money speculators. Because they thrive on crises, they help to create them. In recent weeks, the speculators have been waging an all-out war on the American dollar. I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and in the best interest of the United States.
Are you concerned about these actions by Russia and China to establish different reserves and conduct transactions in non-U.S. dollars?
The U.S. dollar is the widely accepted and really the only serious candidate for the world's principal reserve currency. And that's because of our democratic institutions, our liquid markets, the rule of law, and all those kinds of things. And also the fact that
Japan's yen has hit a new 34-year low. And of course, the US dollar has been pretty strong lately. Inflation showing no signs of coming down decisively.
It's going to be only America first. America first.
So another reason for recording the podcast today on the dollar is that as we speak, there is a developing currency crisis in Japan with the value of the yen crashing against the American currency. And the Fed Wednesday last week warning that interest rates there are likely to remain high for much longer than previously thought. Now, in a sense, this might look like a crisis in a country far away, but it has very real echoes of what brought down Liz Truss here in Britain and that is spooking governments across Europe. So it's a reminder, in a way, of the extraordinary power of the dollar today and how vulnerable those of us outside the US are to decisions taken by the central bank in the States. So in this episode, we want to explore or the story of the dollar's rise to global supremacy up to the financial crisis in 2008. That will take up most of the first half. And in the second half, we're going to turn to how the US uses that power, how it has used that power after 2008 in ways that affect countries as divergent as Ukraine, Venezuela, Britain, Japan, Iran, Russia, and China. And for me, I mean, I've got to admit, Helen's going to be the expert in this episode guiding us through it. I've only kind of over time realize the centrality of the dollar to the global economy, to questions that are affecting Britain. You know, I'm writing a book at the moment about Britain's history in the European Union, and these big moments come that we don't often discuss, like the decision in the 70s to end the Bretton Woods system and how that has an enormous effect on Britain. So I think this question is so central, but it kind of almost lies hidden out of sight for most of us as we think about the world today, Helen.
I think the 70s is a really crucial juncture in this story, Tom, because it brought one era to an end and another era began. And that, I would say, culminated in the 2008 financial crash. And we are now living in the world, in a sense, where the dollar's concerned, that the crash created, all the American response to the crash created. But in order to understand why the 70s turned out to be so significant, I think we need to go back to the middle of the Second World War, towards the end of the Second World War, 1944, and the creation of the Bretton Woods system. That was done at an international monetary conference of the wartime allies. So included, obviously, the United States was the host of the conference at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire, Britain, and it included the Soviet Union. So it excluded the states that the Allies were at war with. And that, in terms of the way in which Bretton Woods was originally set up, was quite consequential. But I think if we want to understand the Bretton Woods story as a story about how the dollar decisively became the world's international currency, because you could argue its rise had begun in the first half of the 20th century, but this is a moment where the United States clearly has the world's most important currency, and everybody else accepts that. We need to start in 1944 with what the Franklin Roosevelt administration wanted to achieve in establishing, once peace came, an international monetary system. And what that they wanted, and the most important American official at the Bretton Woods negotiations, was a man called Harry Dexter White. He wanted everybody to understand that the dollar was the most important currency, that it's the currency that should be treated as the norm for international trade in the post-war world, and that it was going to have a privileged position in the exchange rate system which they were creating. So the exchange rate system pegged currencies against each other in real terms, or in meaningful terms, against the dollar. So, for instance, priced against the dollar uniquely had a value against gold, $35 an ounce. And the dollar could be converted by foreign central banks into gold at that rate. And the idea behind the system, as a monetary system then, was as long as the Americans held the value of gold at $35 an ounce, that would provide stability.
This is what was agreed at Bretton Woods.
This is what was agreed at Bretton Woods. And if you think about it in terms of what the Americans wanted to achieve, they were effectively creating a monetary system that would support a trading system that would have the dollar at the center of it. And actually, in the way in which the exchange rate system would work, they were making it such that other governments would have, to all intents and purposes, to have the agreement of the American government in order to devalue their currencies by any meaningful amount against the dollar. So it was giving the United States effectively a veto on how other states could manage their exchange rates. And that went back to the way in which Franklin Roosevelt, when he first came into office in 1933, wanted to, or was angry, perhaps would be a better way of putting it, at what he saw as other states, meaning primarily the British, devaluing their currency against the dollar. And he reacted to that by taking the United States off gold. So this was, in a way, a system which said, we're not having any repetition of what happened in the 1930s again, and we are now powerful enough to create rules around the dollar's primacy.
That's fascinating, because if you go back before the Second World War, it was actually the link between the US dollar and gold and the value of the currency in other countries undercutting the dollar was a source of a real genuine sort of populist uprising, I think, which threatened both of the main parties. It was a kind of pre-Trump-like kind of populist uprising, if you like. So I hadn't sort of connected the two and how that sort of thread links all the way through to Roosevelt in the war. I mean, I suppose the obvious question for me is, why are we agreeing to this? I mean, Britain and the Soviet Union at this time, I assume, it's just because we are so weak and we're so dependent on them.
Absolutely, is both Britain and the Soviet Union are entirely dependent upon lend-lease arrangements with the United States at that point. So this is 1944. And both Britain and the Soviet Union are buying goods from the United States and going to pay for them when the war is over. Now, one of the reasons why Bretton Woods doesn't turn out in the way in which its architects intended for it is that quite quickly after the war is ended, so by the end of 1945, Stalin has thought twice about the idea of having the United States act as a creditor to the Soviet Union, because he understands that conditions are going to be attached to any loans that they end up Soviets end up taking from what has been created as the International Monetary Fund that we still have today. There are some people in Britain, in the British Parliament, some people at the Bank of England who said we have to find an alternative to agreeing to a dollar-based international system. But Britain's principal representative at Bretton Woods, John Maynard Keynes, the economist who was working in the wartime treasury, said essentially to them, look, get real.
Yeah.
Look at our financial position.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't going to end our financial dependency upon the United States when this war is over. It's going to continue. And we are not in a position, we Britain, I mean by that, to aspire any longer to rival the United States with sterling as an international currency. Now, the British government did insist that when it came to there being formal international reserve currencies as part of the system that had been created, that sterling was the second currency, but it was very much the second currency and not the first currency.
It makes you think about the Second World War in a completely different frame, in a way that if you're thinking about it in a British frame, obviously you have the classic story. But another way is of, you know, almost like our era's 7 years war that brought Britain to global supremacy. This was the war that brought America to global supremacy, financially, militarily, everything. We know that anyway, but seeing it through the lens of monetary power is interesting.
Yeah, but I think that you could say that, I mean, with the caveat that I'm going to come to, is that here the monetary power was considerably more than the military power. And I'm not trying to minimize the contribution of American military power to winning the Second World War in saying that. What I'm saying is that the Soviet Union is, by the latter part of the 1940s, still a very significant military power, to the point that it has been able to subjugate Eastern Europe and project power in other parts of the world as well, not least, or at least trying to, in the Middle East. There isn't anybody who can challenge the United States in the monetary sphere. Now, it is also true that the Soviet bloc stays entirely outside the Bretton Woods system. So the defeated powers, Germany and Japan, come into it, which wasn't intended at Bretton Woods, and the Soviet bloc is outside it. So it's not a global monetary system. And in that sense, it doesn't bring global American monetary dominance.
But it creates the West that
exists.
But
it clearly, in terms of the Western countries economically, it puts the dollar at the center of the system.
So I suppose then the other obvious question for me is then, why on earth would you start to unpick that in the 1970s if it's brought you such power and dominance?
Well, I think that this is where it doesn't quite turn out either how the Americans intended, or at least that Harry Dexter White intended, because he wanted to preserve the dollar's position in the formal sense by this link with gold, by saying it would be the only currency that's convertible to gold in the system. But that meant that the United States, at least in principle, had to have an economic policy that guaranteed the convertibility of dollars into gold. But if you have an international trade system, which you want to continue to expand, and dollars to be the currency that's used for that international trade system, then you're going to end up with more and more dollars in the world if the trade part of it is successful. And your supply of gold in order to back those dollars isn't necessarily going to expand at the same rate. So what you can already see by the early 1960s is that the Americans can't redeem their promise on convertibility. So you then have to do lots of things that would encourage central banks not to ask for their dollars to be converted into gold. And there's one politician, who won't surprise you, I think, who it is, in the middle of the 1960s, who makes a great big dramatic performance of saying, I want gold for my dollars or my country's dollars, and that's Charles de Gaulle. And he sees that he sees that very much as a critique, as a way of holding up to the mirror in some sense what he thinks of as, he's quite in a way happy to use the language of imperial American privileges. But if you look at it from the American side, that doesn't look like that at all. If you go to the beginning of 1968, so the time of the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, the pressure that's coming on Lyndon Johnson, there's a lot of pressure on the dollar, and including from demands for gold at that point. And Johnson, unlike Richard Nixon in 1971, thinks that America must honour the principle of dollar-gold convertibility. It must keep the system together. And faced with that financial crisis, he doesn't pull out of Vietnam, obviously, but he has to pause on the bombing of North Vietnam. He announces that he's not going to run for president again. And it's quite a turning point in the war. And behind that is choosing, like, are we going to carry on being the anchor of this monetary system? Are we going to adjust our domestic economy in ways that would produce less growth, higher unemployment, perhaps, in order to maintain? He doesn't want to do that. So he pulls back from the military commitment. What then changes in the 1970s is when the crisis reoccurs, and there's reasons which would come to in terms of the nature of the 1970s in a moment why it's likely to reoccur. Nixon, Richard Nixon, in the summer of August of 1971, he decides differently. He says, well, stuff the system, stuff the multilateral rules. America first, in that sense, it is a Trumpian moment. If we can, it just shows that there's a history to American first that goes way beyond Trump. He says the American domestic economy comes first, and he doesn't even bother consulting any of the West European governments, even though it's a multilateral international monetary system that he's, to all intents and purposes, dismantling the core of over a weekend.
And he's doing that by saying no longer it convertible to gold.
Yes.
And so he just unmoors it.
Yeah. So you still have the Bretton Woods system in terms of its fixed exchange rate part of its system. That lasts for another 18 months or so. That comes to an end in March 1973. And that brings the world that we now know of floating exchange rates, where the value of exchange rates is being determined by buying and selling, you know, in the foreign exchange markets. But the crucial watershed moment is August of 1971. Now, you could say at this point, well, how then, if the Americans have dismantled the thing that privileged the currency, at least in a formal sense, how do they continue to have the dollar be the dominant currency? And I think, because that in a way is a question of the middle of the 1970s. And there is moments, I think, when there's fear in Washington, New York, that the dollar's preeminence might slip away from them. But I think there's two things that provide the answer to it. The first of them is that the dollar has been the currency in which oil has been denominated. And even after you get the energy nationalism in the Middle East in the 1970s that we've talked about before, there's a willingness, particularly by Saudi Arabia, which effectively sets the rules for what OPEC is doing, to say, well, continue with the dollar. And the other reason is because all the while that the Bretton Woods system has been in place, at least since the second half of the 1950s, there's been, if you like, a shadow dollar system, which is the Eurodollar markets in London, where you've got dollars that are created not by the American state, but by banks. Right. And there's many more dollars floating around in this system than the Federal Reserve, the American central banks, got any idea about how many there are, let alone any idea that it could control. And the world's banking system increasingly comes to use, or big international banks increasingly come to use, these euro dollars.
I find this moment in time absolutely extraordinary. First of all, the very idea that European banks can create dollars, you know, create money. But I suppose to some extent that's what everybody does. That's what money is. It's the, you know, it's the create, it's created by somebody, and we all just have to believe that it exists for it to work, especially when it's not loaded in this physical product, you know, which is gold. You know, once it's out of that, then what is it?
Yeah, well, that's a very deep question.
Yes, yes.
We spend a lot of time that I'm not really sure that we get to an answer by trying to answer. I think what is important to see, because this really does matter for what happens in like 2008, is that particularly from the 1970s onwards, well, you could say, let's sort of nail it to a date, to August of 1971, or to a month anyway. Once you've entered dollar gold convertibility, you have what then's called the fiat currency. So you have the dollars that are backed by the American state. Mm-hmm. But then there are all these dollars growing in volume that are circulating in London markets, not just by European banks, but at this point primarily around European banks. American banks are joining into that market too. And they're beyond the Federal Reserve's control. And what's really interesting about this is that what happens in that, let's call it like shadow dollar system, mm-hmm. for a shorthand. So it's these euro dollars that are at the center of the 2007-08 crash. And we'll come to that in a moment. But there's just one more thing that I want to get in before we get to the crash. And that's what happens in the first, let's say, decade or so after the end of the Bretton Woods system. Mm-hmm. And that is just how difficult the monetary environment becomes for lots of states. And that's true for Western European states. It's true for developing country states. Think of the developing country debt crisis in the 1980s. And what you can see in that period is that when the Americans are running a domestic economic policy that lends itself to dollar strength, and that includes the period when the Federal Reserve under Paul Volcker is raising interest rates to a very high level, significantly higher than they are now, that makes it incredibly difficult for everybody else, both for those countries that have got lots of debt in dollars because now they need more of their own currency in order to service those dollar debts, but it also makes all those goods that are being denominated in dollars, not least oil, more expensive. And it's out of the problems that dollar strength causes for other states that ultimately the European Union ends up with a monetary union. Now we could spend more time explaining the sequence of that, and maybe leave that for another time. But just to stress for the moment, because I think it comes back to the problems that Japan has got now, is that what happens to the American currency in a free-floating exchange rate system when it can go very high or it can go very low has profound consequences for others that bring about quite significant change.
I was going to ask you about that because, I mean, the obvious conclusion for me is that you see this great change happening in 1971, and then you see a great decade of crisis in Britain that follows. I mean, what I was trying to unpick was we'd already started to have currency issues in the late 60s that culminate in Harold Wilson devaluing. So could he do that independently? And how different is that then to what happens in the 70s, where we have these crisis of both a falling pound, and then when we discover North Sea oil, or North Sea oil starts to come in, that we then have this fear that we're going to have, I think, what was called the Dutch disease at the time, which was a too high a value on the pound that would then cause us problems domestically.
Yeah, the Americans do accept the devaluation of sterling at quite, I mean, it's a not insignificant one, so it would fall under the part that where you need the consent of the IMF in order to do that. They're very unhappy about the sterling devaluation in 1967. I mean, part of that unhappiness, I think, is also bound up with they see that it's going to be the end of the British presence east of Suez, and that two things go together. What happens in the case of Britain then in the middle of the 70s is that particular issue of sterling's weakness in the post-Bretton Woods world comes to a fore in March of 1976, when the sterling crisis begins, and that's what leads the Labour government to have to go to the IMF in a rather humiliating way to ask for a loan. Now, there's no doubt that North Sea oil and the prospect of North Sea oil makes it easier for the British government, both that Labour government and then Thatcher's government, to deal with the exchange rate constraint that would have otherwise been the case. Indeed, there's a moment where I think it might even be Kissinger when he was working for Ford, who's saying that if it weren't for North Sea oil, then tougher conditions would be imposed by the IMF on Britain. But they understand that Britain's balance of payments will improve and its currency problems will be less once Britain's importing less oil from abroad. What is true, though, is that in the first part of the first Thatcher government, that the conjunction of North Sea oil plus the very high interest rates that the Thatcher government itself wants in order to deal with inflation then send sterling soaring high to about $2.40 at its peak, I think. And that causes a whole set of other problems, not least making the exports of the manufacturing sector like very uncompetitive. But it's interesting that it takes hardly any time at all to go from that problem to the Thatcher government a few years later dealing with sterling at nearly parity.
I mean, is that the point then, that the challenge is the volatility? Like we become sort of flapping in the wind, unmoored from this system that has broken down. And so you get 1976 and the IMF bailout, which if Kissinger's saying that there would have been harsher conditions, I mean, just go back and look at the conditions that we had to deal with. I mean, they make the sort of austerity post-2010 seem sort of benign in comparison. And then from $2.40 a dollar to one to parity, yeah, I mean, it's just extraordinary.
It takes about 4 years for that. It's January of 1985 by the time it's at $1.03.
But that is very volatile.
There's absolutely no doubt. And if you look at some of the other things that happened in that time, like the Mitterrand's failed experiment, it's bound up with the problem of a weak franc against the dollar. I mean, it's played out in a way through the German currency in the French case too, though you could argue by the end of the 80s that's true for Britain. But I think the central point here is to see how that the 70s and most of the 80s is a period in which the politics of European countries, or West European countries anyway, is shaped in some really quite important ways by the difficulty of dealing with the monetary and the exchange rate environment. Then we have this period that's more benign in that respect, which runs really from the middle of the 1990s through to maybe 2004-2005-ish, you start to see some issues, not really severe, but some issues when the Federal Reserve starts raising American interest rates in 2004. But whilst that issue is slightly coming back but is largely benign, what we can see by 2007, so when the financial crisis began in the August of that year, is that the Eurodollar system, the system that runs off dollars through the world's internationalized banks, really European and American banks at this point, is itself got strong tendencies to instability that come to the surface. And that at the moment of crisis, the only institution of any kind that can rescue the system, it's not even the American government, it's the American Central Bank, it's the Federal Reserve. And they provide large direct loans to European banks, and then they provide what come to be called dollar swap lines. So it's basically a line of credit being extended to the central banks. So say European Central Bank of England that then pass those credit lines on to banks so that they are able to carry on borrowing dollars. If the Federal Reserve had not done those things and provided that dollar credit, then we wouldn't have got out. I mean, I can't even really quite find words to describe like what would have happened to the international financial system. But it's a really revealing moment because it's the point when something that the Federal Reserve, the American Central Bank, hasn't had control of in any meaningful way, it has to act as the lender of last resort to. It has to be the backup for the entire system. And once it's done that, then an era has come to an end again, I would say. And then we're into the world in which we now live, where the Federal Reserve, I would say in a way, has more power than it's ever had in terms of, if we take power to mean impact on the rest of the world.
I would say, just to stress how important I think I've come to understand this moment, if we're just thinking about it through a British lens and how the economy would have imploded more than it imploded at the time, and that we were dependent on this foreign institution, completely unelected foreign institution that needed to bail us out. That realization, I don't know how much it's kind of seeped into the political consciousness here and what are the consequences of that? Because that story that you were painting before, Helen, in the 70s and 80s, and how Europe was trying to respond to the volatility that it was kind of suffering under, was to try and form the euro, as you kind of quickly mentioned. And that incredible kind of political crisis that presented to Britain to know what to do. I mean, it resulted really in the end of one Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, a new one in John Major. It resulted in Black Wednesday and our attempt to tie ourselves to the Deutschmark, which then ended John Major's premiership. Tony Blair set himself up. His central goal was to get us into the euro. And that didn't work because of this decade that you talked about, the nice decade where things seemed to have calmed down. The British economy was doing well. Tony Blair leaves and the whole system blows up in 2008 and a new one comes into being. When you think about it, it's so fundamentally tied in to the world that was created in either Bretton Woods or 1971. And it just strikes me that there are some ironies here about, we were very, very concerned for good, understandable reasons about handing over control to the European Central Bank that would then set interest rates for the whole of Europe. And would they be good for Britain here, or would interest rates be better set by the Bank of England? And yet when it came down to it, we hadn't appreciated that under it all, the most important bank was not the Bank of England, it was the Fed. And we had no control over what they were going to do, and we still don't.
No, but you could argue that the Fed also had no control, had no choice, might be a better way of putting it, because from its point of view, if it had said, well, screw the European banks, then the deep integration in these international dollar markets for bank funding between American banks and European banks would have been devastating for American banks, and the financial crisis was already devastating for some American investment banks, as we know, and the whole system would, I don't even know how to think about, like, what happens if you have the entire meltdown of the
too big to fail, like
the international financial system at that point. So in that sense, it's a story not so much about state to state power relations in the build up to this, but about the fact that this whole world of dollar banking was going on without any knowing safeguards in place, unless you would just assume that the bankers always thought, well, in the final instance, when it really comes, the Fed will have no choice but to bail us out. We say that's probably what that they did think. But I think that once you see what happened, because the Fed did do that, everybody thereafter understands that it really matters, like, what kind of access that you have to American support in the emergency. And that's what we're going to talk about it's where we're going to begin anyway, in the second half, because that turns out to be a quite sharply geopolitical question.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome back, everyone. So we finished the first half there in the world of 2008, or the world really that the Fed in New York created in 2008 with these dollar swaps, where they're effectively bailing out much of Europe, who had found themselves way over their heads in these euro dollars that they had created. And are still,
well, the European banks anyway. We should say it's primarily North European countries. It's not the whole of Europe that's got itself into this situation.
Yeah, and we should also say that this time we've got much of North European, you know, lecturing the Americans on how terrible their system is, when it was us who almost blew up the world, you know, in part. But I mean, so that I guess the question then is, if the Fed has established these lines, bailout lines or dollar swaps, where are these lines going? Who are they connected to? Are they? Does everybody in the world get them, or is it a privileged access for American allies?
Oh, it's very much privileged access. I think you can say that over the next 5 years or so, and we can see this going on till this day, that there's a hierarchy.
Mm.
And that at the very top of the hierarchy are those central banks that are at the core, as it then was, of the euro dollar system. So the big recipients, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of Canada, the National Bank of Switzerland. And although that this isn't initially made permanent, it soon after, or relatively a few years after 2008 does, those central banks have access to dollar swaps to all intents and purposes any time that they need them without condition. Then you've got another tier where they're pretty much available, not quite as condition free. So that was Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, South Korea, Brazil, Mexico, Denmark, Norway and Sweden. So the interesting ones there, you could say, are Singapore, South Korea, Brazil and Mexico.
Mm.
And that probably has less to do with systemic importance to the international banks, perhaps with the exception of Singapore, than their relations with the United States. And then you have the states that are just left outside the system. Now, I want to come back and talk about one of those in particular in a moment. But if we just continue the story through from, because I think there is another set of countries with one in particular at the center of it that do really matter in this hierarchy, and that's China. Because if you look at the decade through the 2010s, what is true is that Chinese banks are becoming much more important, and European banks, in response to what had happened in the crash, are becoming less important. So
right, yeah.
you have many more European banks in the top 10 biggest banks in the world in the 2000s. In the 2010s, I think there's one of them left.
Right.
And at least half of them are Chinese banks. And these Chinese banks are integrating themselves into this euro dollar system for banking. So there's a huge question that hangs over that whole decade, or at least by the middle of it, I would say, is, well, what happens if China might need a dollar swap line? Is that the point in which American policy is becoming generally more confrontational towards China, particularly once Donald Trump is president? Is the Fed then going to provide a dollar swap line?
Yeah.
Because you couldn't say it wouldn't be systemically important. Because,
no, the most systemically important.
Because of China, because of the way that the Chinese banks have gone during the decade. And the moment does come, I think. It comes in March 2020, the financial crisis at the beginning of the pandemic, or the beginning of the pandemic in chronological terms in Europe's sense, in Europe and the United States. And the Fed doesn't provide a dollar swap line, but it does provide an indirect means for China to access credit from the Federal Reserve using their treasury bond reserves as holdings, as collateral. So
using, sorry, China's
treasury holdings of US treasury bonds.
Because I was going to say, that seems to be the sort of elephant in the room, that at this time that China is integrating it into this American system, it is also becoming the biggest holder of American debt and its great sort of trade partner. They are, you know, you've got American companies in China. China's becoming a great exporter to the United States. This is the beginnings of Chimerica, isn't it? The sort of Neil Ferguson idea.
Well, I think that what's really interesting about that is the divergence in what's going on. If you think about that in trade terms and in monetary terms and in banking terms. So if you look at the 2000s, I mean by that the first decade of this century, that's the decade of Chimerica. And that's the period in which the Chinese central bank is buying a lot of American debt. I mean, you could go as far to argue, I think, that during that decade and the very early part of the next decade, that China was acting as a structural creditor to the United States. And that was then a constraint on what the Americans could do in dealing with China, including the possibility of putting tariffs on them, which was being demanded by some in Congress as early as like 2003, 2004.
Because the Chinese had been brought into the world trade system at that time.
Exactly. Yeah. If you though then move into the decisively into the 2010s, this is an era in which, first of all, the United States is reducing its trade deficit because of the shale oil boom. It's importing less oil. But it's also the era of quantitative easing, in which debt isn't necessarily being dealt with by issuing debt that's got to be sold to foreigners in the case. It's being dealt with by, to all intents and purposes, the Fed printing money. And so China's less important, I think, as a creditor in that decade. And that's the same decade in which the Chinese banks are getting deeper into the euro-dollar system. And what you see by the middle of the decade, 2015, 2016, is what the Federal Reserve is doing with its interest rates, having profound consequences for China, because China is now more exposed to the United States in monetary and financial terms than it was 10 years earlier. So when it becomes clear that the Federal Reserve and Janet Yellen were going to raise interest rates just by a quarter of percent from 0 to 0.25% at the end of the year, at the end of 2015, that was enough to send China into a financial crisis, a very bad financial crisis in the summer of 2015. And that was a period in which the dollar was rising. This is a story that is ongoing now, like for Japan, when I say with some consequences for China. And what we saw in early, I think it was February of 2016, was something called the Shanghai Accord, which was an agreement to allow the dollar to come down. And part of the reason for that was China's need for it, because China was getting so hurt by the prospect of higher American interest rates and a strong dollar. So in a way, China's influence over the United States in monetary and financial terms is decreased.
Yes.
Substantially decreased. And the 2008 is really, for a number of reasons, actually not just the financial crash in this respect, because the shale part is part of the story too, is a turning point here.
In a way, is China's owning all of this American debt, it leaves it in a vulnerable position as well to the Americans using things like QE, because the fear presumably is that they're going to inflate away their debt, which then China is vulnerable to because it's holding so much of it.
Yeah, there's very much a fear in the immediate years after the crash that in China, that's what the Americans are going to do. And part of the reason why we're going to come to this in a while, shall we say, of why China is keen post-crash to internationalize its own currency is to try to deal with that problem. But I think we should probably just nip back into the hierarchy because we had the countries like, or central banks like ECB, European Central Bank of England, etc. at the top. Then we've got Australia, New Zealand, etc. We've got China in this sort of grey zone from March 2020 anyway. But then we've got everyone who's just left outside it. And everyone who's left outside it has to make do with the International Monetary Fund.
Right.
And some of those countries are going to find, particularly if they've got a lot of dollar debt, that is going to be a big problem for them at times when the dollar is strong. But even when it isn't strong, if you've got something going on in your country that is causing severe financial difficulty and you are left outside and you're told to make do with the IMF, that has, I think, profound geopolitical consequences. And exhibit A of this is Ukraine.
Right. And can I just ask on that a sort of simple question then? When you go to the IMF, you get loans in dollars. Is that why you then become indebted in dollars? And then you become ever more vulnerable to the strength of the dollar and the strength of the US economy, the Fed increasing interest rates?
Well, a lot of the times is that what's going on is that they're going to the IMF because they need to service dollar debt.
And how they got that in the first place? Just because they're a weak economy?
Well, a lot of the debt in the world is denominated in dollars. So, and even, and this will come to this point, quite a lot of the lending that China has done as part of the Belt and Road has been done in dollars.
Right.
So you can end up with dollar debt from here, there, and everywhere. So
because it comes back to the point that it's the dominant currency. The dominant currency.
And so I think that the reason why Ukraine is such an interesting and dramatic case of this is that Ukraine suffered really badly from the financial crisis in 2007-08. I mean, Ukraine had never had a particularly strong economy during the entire period of independence from like 1991, but it was hit very hard by the crash and in needing financial support in 2013. And part of the reason why it did was because in the summer of 2013 or the late spring of 2013, the Fed was giving its first signals, not even that it was going to raise interest rates, but it was going to slow down quantitative easing.
Right.
And that spooked financial markets.
Because it indicated that interest rates would go up in that thing.
And then so Ukraine was faced with an even worse financial position than it had been in a few months earlier. It asks the EU, remember this is the point when it's about to sign this, when Yanukovych is about to sign the associate membership agreement with the European Union and the IMF for help. Some help's on offer, but it's not that much and it's on quite strict terms. So instead he asked Putin, well, what can you do to help me? And much more generous answer comes back. Yanukovych rips up the association agreement, as we know, turns to Putin, and events are set in motion that lead to his removal from power after the popular uprising. And then in the wake of that and the new government in Ukraine, Putin's annexation of Crimea.
It makes you think about these things completely differently, because you can think about Ukrainian history, and we have done on this podcast, as a long story of the collapse of the Soviet Union. That is obviously a one way to think about it, but this way of thinking about it, as a consequence of the new world that's emerged post 2008. I mean, not to link Ukraine too much to Britain, but it does strike me that you're in a similar time period here of Britain's withdrawal from the European Union, which again is not understandable if you don't think about this financial world that is...
Via the Eurozone crisis, absolutely.
Exactly. So you've got the trigger for Brexit, let's say, is 2011, Cameron vetoing the moves from the European leaders to save the Eurozone. And the Eurozone crisis has emerged from the 2008 crisis. And
more than that, I think you could go push that point a bit further. Actually, if you look at the peaks of the Eurozone crisis in 2011 and 2012, so the points when there's most pressure on the southern European states plus Ireland, and by 2011-12 it's a bit less Ireland, they come at exactly the same time in which the northern European banks that are most exposed in these dollar funding markets need most help from the Federal Reserve in terms of dollar swaps. So almost all the peaks of the Eurozone crisis in terms of market pressure are also the points when the Eurozone is, or the European Central Bank, I should say, is taking the most volume of dollars from the Fed. So they're completely tied together.
And I mean, again, as we said in the first half, the very creation of the euro is to deal with the volatility that has emerged as a result of the 1971. Which has seen Britain not be able to join, which has set it on this path to a different place. And so that when you get to 2010, you have David Cameron as leader of the opposition saying, we do not want anything to do with your bailouts of your own currency. We didn't join the currency. You've got your own problems caused by your own decisions. We don't want anything to do with it. And negotiates out of, I think, what Alistair Darling, the Chancellor, the Labour Chancellor, had kept Britain inside the bailout system. And so that then leads to the veto that leads Cameron to his conclusion that Britain needs greater protections within the euro, that leads to his decision to offer the referendum and And the rest is history. So it's just remarkable to think about it like that. And then, as you say, Ukraine. And then that, I suppose, that should bring us back to all the way to the to what we mentioned at the very beginning of this episode, which is Japan, which does seem to be having, you know, sort of similar issues to what we're dealing with on the, on this side of the world. And it is striking, isn't it? Because Japan, when Donald Trump emerges as a political figure in the late 1980s, before he starts being concerned about China, his big concern is Japan. And Japan is the is in effect at that time the great threat to America. It is seen as, I think at one point at this time, it takes over as the world's biggest economy. It is seen as the, it is outcompeting the United States, and it's also free riding. So it's the, it's almost like the, how Trump talks about Germany today. That's how he was talking about Japan, but in a sense also thinking about it as the, as a pre-China. And then that swaps to how he thinks about China today. But since then, you know, since that moment, Japan just seemed completely...
But this, Tom, is another way in which the story connects back together again to what we were talking about in the 80s, because when we were talking about the 80s, we concentrated on the European countries, France and Britain, how the monetary union came out of it. But you could argue that the biggest casualty of American monetary power in the latter part of the 80s was Japan, and that Japan has never recovered from what happened. So if you told the story of what happened to the dollar through that decade, so we'd start the decade like in 1970, the late 70s really, with Paul Volcker at the Federal Reserve, you have this very high interest rates that leads relatively quickly to the dollar surging. So you have a very strong dollar all the way till to 1985. And then partly in response to what's growing protectionist pressure in the US Congress, Reagan, Ronald Reagan, decides that they need to change course, and that in order to deal with that problem of the hit that American exporters, manufacturing exports have taken from a strong dollar, they need to get the dollar down. And there's a couple of international agreements, one called the Platts Accord in 1985, one called the Louvre Accord in 87. The first of them kind of works, doing what the Reagan administration wants. But by the time they get to the second one in 1987, they're starting to fear that the dollar's going to fall too far. And so they actually want considerable Japanese help in order to stop that happening. And that encouraged the, I think encourage might be too gentler word, perhaps somewhere nearer bullying Japan into cutting interest rates in Japan and create the conditions for the credit bubble in Japan that then crashes, Japanese stock market crash, the end of 1989, the beginning of 1990. And it is since then, in a way, that the Japanese economy has never recovered from that story that you were telling, where it's being seen by some in the United States as a threat to the American position, that Japan did not get to choose for itself how it dealt with the monetary and exchange rate problems that it faced in the early 1980s. And in one sense, it's paid the consequence. And one of the ways then, I mean, there's many ways we don't need to get into about the way which Japanese governments and the Japanese Central Bank have dealt with things since then. But the upshot of it all is various fiscal stimuluses have left Japan with a high level of state debt, of government debt.
Extraordinarily high.
And well over like 200%. And that in order to sustain that, they need interest rates to be very low. So when the Federal Reserve started to respond to energy inflation in 2022 by increasing interest rates, everyone else, as we know, has reluctantly, perhaps not always as speedily as the Fed, done the same. But the Bank of Japan has tried to hold the line. It kept them nearer zero. It did raise them a little bit earlier, like in the year. But now it's trying to defend its currency, which is coming under severe downward pressure, without doing the thing that you should do to protect your currency, which is to raise interest rates, because it can't.
Yeah.
Because there's so much debt to deal with all the cumulative economic problems it's had for the last 30 years, that it would jeopardise its ability to maintain that volume of debt if it were to raise interest rates. But if it doesn't raise interest rates, its currency is going to keep coming under a considerable pressure. Now, earlier in the week, earlier last week, I should say, even when we're talking, the Bank of Japan was intervening itself in the foreign exchange markets to try to stabilise the yen, and it did manage to do that for 48 hours or so. But at least when we're talking at the moment, then the effect of that's already worn off.
It's an amazing story because Japan, to many, including me, is a kind of equated with enlightened governance, progress, modernity. And yet, here it is with, I think from the notes that you sent me earlier, Helen, 274% debt of GDP as its debt burden. In a bind that, as you explain it there, seems almost impossible to get out of. Now, how do you protect yourself in this world where America, if the American economy is booming like it is, and the Federal Reserve is increasing interest rates, it's only going to drive down your currency. And so you're just stuck with a choice of a crash in your currency or a crash in your economy if you try and hike interest rates and yourself with all the
amount of debt.
And in
a way, it's even worse because in a way, I think that what's happening with Japan, I mean, there's structural reasons why you would expect Japan's currency to come under pressure because its interest rates are so low compared to others, and it's not in some sense playing the game. It's also true, I think, that because pressure on the yen downwards, the Japanese currency tends to bring pressure on the Chinese currency downwards, and because a weakening yen in relation to the Chinese currency directly hurts Chinese exporters, that there are problems for China that come with this. And you might say that the Biden administration, has had some interest in encouraging those problems for China. So it's not necessarily incentivized to help the Japanese stabilize the yen because there's a payoff for the Biden administration bringing pressure upon China, i.e. encouraging the Chinese to increase their domestic consumption and rely less on exports. And this is yet another example of the way in which the United States can exercise power. I think that the Chinese leadership have been well aware of all the problems that this brings, the system as it now is, from the aftermath of the crash back in 2008. And their response to that was to try to internationalize the Chinese currency. But that has turned out to be a lot more difficult than they imagined.
It's also a story that explains Britain as well, because they tried to internationalize their currency through the City of London. And we thought this was going to be our great boon, another way that we could get rich quick. And it turned out to be a mirage because they are, in a sense, not strong enough to turn their currency international.
Absolutely. And there's two things that we've already mentioned that I think really show that. The first is the fact that Belt and Road, which in one sense is a Eurasian turn against American power from the Chinese, it was supposed to run through renminbi, the Chinese currency. It ended up primarily running through dollars. And then one of the reasons why what progress was being made by the Chinese in terms of internationalizing the currency sort of came to a halt was that Chinese financial crisis in 2015, 2016, which had in its origins the fact that China couldn't deal with the prospect of higher American interest rates.
Yeah. You know, politically, the thing that strikes me, and I guess this will sort of take us to another place where we want to get to, which is the resistance to this system. You know, so there is a resistance to this system, understandably, from those countries that sit outside the American order: Russia, China, Venezuela, Iran, North Korea, the revisionist powers. I think you've called them, Helen, before. I think somebody else has called them not an axis of evil anymore, but it's a axis of upheaval or something. Is some of the terms that are being thrown around in Washington. I mean, I think that is it. That is interesting, and we should get to that. Given what's happening in Japan and how vulnerable lots of countries in the American system with privileged access to these swap lines are, you wonder where the kind of De Gaulle is clutching the bar of gold and shouting at the Fed is, you know, in populist Western democracies, challenging the system there. Because it strikes me that everybody is quite vulnerable. Even America, which is incredibly powerful because of this system, is incredibly vulnerable to its collapse. So it needs to maintain it because it is also incredibly indebted and would struggle in a system where it wasn't in total control and its bank wasn't the one calling the shots. But nobody seems quite able to challenge it.
No, you can see very clearly the intent to challenge it from the revisionist powers, all the way from China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela. You can see the intent to challenge it, even, I think, from some powers you wouldn't describe that way, but in poorer Asian countries, I think you can see, I think it was last year, that the Bangladeshis announced that they'd be paying for a Russian nuclear reactor in China's currency. Mm-hmm. But these are quite small things from states like that. What the revisionist powers have done is in part trying to use gold, so they're buying significant volumes of gold. And in that sense, it is a bit like a De Gaulle kind of move. We trust gold, we don't trust the dollars. But still, the scale of even China has been buying gold quite rapidly this year of its gold reserves compared to its dollar reserves doesn't compare. And China can't do without its dollar reserves because it's still got to trust that in that moment when the emergency comes that the Fed would actually provide that credit line.
Good luck with that if Donald Trump is president.
And then, I mean, you could say that the Fed is protected from a Trump presidency to some extent, at least.
For a short period. He can remove the chair.
Yeah, that would obviously set off an intense domestic political conflict, I think. He's not averse to those, though, I think.
Yeah.
But one of the things I think that is interesting when you look at what China has tried the hardest in a way to do, which is to have the capacity through a petro yuan to pay for energy imports in its own currency, that it's got various initiatives in place, but it's not making a great deal of difference in terms of the actual volume that it can do business in non-dollars. And if you look at the one thing that might be considered something like a new currency for paying for oil, it's actually the United Arab Emirates' currency. So you do have like Indian refiners paying for their Russian oil using United Arab Emirates currency.
God, that's an extraordinary change.
But I think that in the incentive for doing that is because, in a way, it goes back to the power of the dollar, because India wants to make sure that it avoids the financial sanctions and not have its banks excluded from the American banking system, because that is where, when it comes to the sanctions, that the American power lies in the ability to shut companies and banks out of the American banking system. So one of the things I think that we can see is that the way the system works and the way in which it both allows the Americans to exercise power and the Federal Reserve to set the parameters of other countries' economic choices, it strongly incentivizes resistance to it. But at the same time, actually acting upon that resistance to change the system is proving really quite difficult. Now, you might say that power always destroys itself in the end. So the more the Americans, particularly the more they actively use the system to strengthen their power, the more that they will in the end do to undermine it. On the other hand, it's quite hard to see where another international currency comes from.
Well, I mean, you're just, as you talk there, Helen, you think back to how the Americans use their power on Europe, you know, allied, got these close links to the Federal Reserve, and the Europe tried to pursue an independent policy in regard to Iran and couldn't.
And this was at the center of that because they couldn't find a payments system.
And we just had to give up.
Yeah, because they couldn't find a payment system that would allow them to get around dollar sanctions.
Again, it makes you think there's virtually no political kickback against that. You know, I remember speaking to people in the Foreign Office who thought the American position was just completely wrong, and that they were really adamant that the European position needed to be upheld. The French, German and British position on the Iranian nuclear deal, and they couldn't. And yet again, you know, what has happened to the British position since? It's really to double down on the American a partnership rather than China.
Even the Chinese found difficulty when it comes to Iran. So they signed, which I think we've mentioned before, this 25-year agreement with Iran back in like 2021 that I think that would facilitate a great deal, or in principle was supposed to facilitate a great deal of Chinese investment in the Iranian energy sector. But not much has happened because the Chinese find it very difficult to get around the effect of the dollar sanctions, the financial sanctions on Iran.
I guess the question will be whether the US is willing to continue paying the costs to maintain this system and the power that it has. Because Trump seems evidently more reluctant to continue paying the price, but he wants the power. And so I suppose if I'm trying to think through, as you said about Nixon created this world with no cooperation with these allies. He just ripped the rug out of the old system and created the new system. And for a moment, as you said, it seemed like, well, was that a mistake? But in the end, it doubled down on American power. And then the next crisis made it even more powerful than before. You might say that if Trump just pulls a Nixon, you know, and rips the rug from underneath the international system again, well, it will only reveal American power even more than what
it
is.
Well, I think the difference is that Nixon was the player then, and the president of the Federal Reserve, Arthur Burns, was quite dismayed about what he wanted to do. He kept saying, aren't we going to talk to anybody else? And Nixon was like, why should we?
Yeah.
As was John Connolly, his Treasury Secretary. So that was a system, the Bretton Woods system, that had political control at the centre of it. This system doesn't, I think. This system, the Fed is so central to it. And in one sense, it probably won't make a great deal of difference as to who's the president and the way in which the system works. In fact, I don't think it would unless Trump really decided to have a huge confrontation with the Federal Reserve. But even then, why in a way would he? Because the sanctions part of it is something that he was very keen on using. I mean, after all, he was the person, we talked about this before, maximum economic pressure on Iran, maximum economic pressure on Venezuela. Dollar sanctions are very much...
They provide him the tools.
They provide the tools. I mean, I know there are energy sanctions too, but they're there. And providing these dollar swaps, it doesn't constrain American domestic choices in the way in which Nixon was constrained in August 1971. I mean, Nixon really genuinely feared at that point that if the Federal Reserve had to raise interest rates to defend the dollar gold convertibility, he wouldn't get reelected. I mean, that was a bit fanciful given who the Democrats were going to put up against him, but that was what was going on in his mind. I don't think the Federal Reserve acting as a lender of last resort to the euro dollar market threatens any American president's reelection. And so, in that sense, it's very much a technocratic international financial system.
Yeah, we've ended up, we talk incessantly about the threat of populism and populists. Well, the power that sits behind everything is a great technocratic order that emerged out of the 2008 financial crisis. I mean, that's some irony, but maybe that is the point, that, you know, you have increased technocratic power to manage this incredibly complicated world system that exists today. And you are inevitably going to get democratic populist challenges to that, because it is so technocratic and complicated and hard for anybody to understand. I mean, I think it's been a tour de force from you, Helen, so thank you for that. I'm clearer on it. But I think hopefully the listeners are a bit clearer on the importance of this system. It's just evidently absolutely crucial. So we've run out of time again. I think we've gone over time clearly this week. Thanks very much for listening and see you next time. And as ever, this podcast was produced by Ewan Daughtry.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's armodillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo. Built to last. Designed to impress.